Today we begin the subject of subjects, love. Before we start studying Sri Aurobindo's exposition of the role of love in the integral yoga, I would like to give you an idea of the treatment or the kind of treatment that love for God has been given in the Indian tradition. As you know, when these traditions were formed, scriptures were handed down from mouth to mouth. There was no system of writing. There was no printing paper. And even when writing was systematized, things were written on palm leaves and certain leaves which could stand the test of time. So necessarily, the communication had to be as brief as possible. The teacher would explain the theme and perhaps at the end of it would summarize the whole thing in an abbreviated form in a few words. Now this condensation of a theme to the briefest possible limit is called the sutra in Sanskrit, inadequately translated in English as aphorism. And in India, as Sri Aurobindo has observed somewhere, the passion to develop a science or a tendency to its extreme is so pronounced that even in this science of epitomization, of condensation, they went to the extent of saying that for one who composes or lays down these aphorisms, if he could manage to leave out one word from a sentence, he had as much joy as the birth of a son. That is why the aphorisms of Patanjali on yoga are so brief. One word, two words, three words. And unless there is somebody to expound what is behind the words, what is the content of the words, it is very difficult to know. That is why many scholars who are not familiar with the background of Indian thought have been misled. Now, coming to our subject, the most celebrated treatise on divine love in India is by sage Narada. Narada, who is counted among the sons of God Brahma, he begins, this is the style in which all the sutra treatises, the aphorisms begin. I am not reading out the Sanskrit because it is not going to make much meaning here. He says, he begins always, all the teachers always begin, "Now therefore we shall expound divine love." And immediately he comes to the subject. What is divine love? "That verily is the nature of supreme love of God. Love of God, that is devotion. And it is the supreme love, not the kind of love that we are familiar with on earth, not the kind of love that depends for its existence upon certain antecedent factors, for its growth on certain fulfillment of desires, but something supreme, something transcendent. That love of God, which is uncaused, which does not depend upon other factors, that is true devotion. And what else? In its own intrinsic nature, divine love is immortal. It is immortal. Unlike human love, which is mortal, because it depends upon factors outside itself. But here, it is a self-existent, self-awakened love. It has no end. There may be a stoppage in its manifestation due to various reasons. But to that fount of love from within, there is no end. There is no death. There is no ceasing. That is why it is immortal. Further, if it is there, if the devotion is supreme love, if that supreme love is immortal, what are its effects? That is the third. It says, gaining that, man becomes fulfilled, becomes immortal, becomes satisfied. He is satisfied, becomes conscious of something immortal in him, so that he is no more afraid of death. He is fulfilled. His own existence, his life, he feels it has achieved its purpose. When one is aflame with love for God, when one is consumed in its flame, there is nothing else that a man can desire. He feels life has reached its acme. Nothing, he looks at nothing else, thinks of nothing more. He says in the next, attaining that, he has no more desire for anything. He has no grief. He grieves for nothing. He hates not. He does not rejoice in anything else. Nothing else holds his attention. He has no eagerness for anything. The usual propulsions, the vital propulsions for activity and movement, desire, enthusiasm, enjoyment, hatred of the enemy, which normally move a person into activity, they no more exist for him. These are negative. And what are the positive signs? Says, realizing that, he becomes intoxicated. You remember the famous lines of Sri Aurobindo. I have drunk the giant's wine. He is intoxicated. He is rooted it does not flow out. There is no tendency to go out, not only physically but even mentally and emotionally. He is rooted to that love. He is rooted to that object of love. And he joys in his soul. The whole empire of his joy is in his soul. A very famous expression in the Upanishads. Whole philosophies have been erected out of it. Atma Rama, one who delights in the soul. The self delight not, I'm sorry, not the soul but the self. He delights in the self. But he warns, this love, this devotion is not lust, because it is a form of renunciation. This is an intense love, an intense preoccupation with the delight of the self. But its nature is not of lust, not of conquest, not of domination, but of renunciation. This is the difference. Then he goes on describing other features into which I do not take you at the moment. Then he discusses the characteristics of this devotion, intense devotion leading to love, divine love. He says there are many viewpoints, many sages listed differently. There is, he refers to another sage called Parashara. He describes that this love, this devotion is activation, self-employment in worship and adoration. Another one says, Garga, the Rishi Garga says, it is attachment to talk of God, sacred talk of God. There is another sage, Shandilya, as prominent in this field as Narada. He says, whatever the occupation, it must be without prejudice to one's delight in the self. But Narada himself, after mentioning these differing views even in those early days, records his own estimate, and he says the essential characteristics are consecration of all activities by complete self-surrender to him and extreme anguish if he were to be forgotten. Positively, complete self-surrender within and an exhaustive, comprehensive self-consecration in all activities. Negatively, what mother calls a sense of suffocation, fish out of water, what he calls anguish, if God were to be forgotten. These are the characteristics. And then, the ancient Indian tradition speaks of 9 forms of devotion. They are at once movements for the expression of devotion as also feeders for the flame of divine love. They are Shravanam, listening to the glories of God, listening to the legends and histories of God-men, receiving the vibrations through the sense of hearing. Kirtana, laudation, praising of the Lord from the depth of your heart. Smaranam, remembrance, whatever you are doing, whatever the movement, to remember what the mother says, remember and offer, remember and serve. Then, service, physical service implies the consecration even at the physical level, not merely a theory in the mind, not merely an attitude of the heart, but an actual exertion, a pouring out on the physical plane of one's attitude of submission and consecration. Archanam is worship. Maybe worship, physical worship through flowers, incense, water and the like, or an inner worship, visualizing with the Lord, visualizing with the Divine in any form, and pouring out one's emotions, the best of oneself. Then bowing down. Now bowing down is not merely a physical act of folding the hands or bending the head. It is the last end result of an inner attitude of submission. Then dasyam, that is an attitude of servant, readiness to be of help, to be of use, whatever the nature of the service that may be demanded of the divine, by the divine. Sakhyam, that is at once, at the same time, the attitude of a servant, attitude of a servitor, as mother calls it, there is also the attitude of a friend, of a comrade. The divine reveals itself in many aspects. The devotee has to be ready to meet and greet the Lord in any poise, and then complete self-surrender in all the parts, in all the planes of the being, at all times, in all places. A complete self-surrender. These are the 9 limbs of divine love. Then further, he asks the question himself, when one experiences the divine love, what is its form? Can you describe? He says, it cannot be described. The sap of divine love, when the divine love courses through one's veins, can you really describe it to another? He says, when a dumb man tastes a delicacy, can he really describe the taste? Describe what he feels? This is as such. It is indescribable. Then he adds, attaining that, one sees only that, one hears only that, one talks only that, one thinks only that. When one does nothing else, then it is a sign that he is consumed by the divine love. the approach he did discussing the several types of God lovers, those who aspire for divine love, he analyzes following the Gita that there are four types of those who aspire and seek for divine love. Four types of devotees. First, those who are in distress, who are in physical, psychological or any kind of distress in their life, and they seek the help of God. They are, and they pray with devotion. Their devotion increases in the measure of the help which they receive. This is the first category, and perhaps the lowest category of the devotees who tread the path of devotion. Second, those who seek material welfare, material benefit from God, that also he grants. This is the second category. Third, they know something of God, maybe by hearing, maybe by reading, maybe by experience. They want to know more. And in their knowledge, in their seeking for that knowledge, their devotion grows. This is the third category. Those who are ever desirous of knowing the Lord. There is the fourth category, whom Lord Krishna describes in the Gita as those who are dearest to him. They are those who are the knowers of God. And a knower of God, by knower of God, he does not mean a philosopher, one who knows the metaphysics, who has studied the treatises and known the definitions of the absolute, the immutable, the formless and all that, but who knows God intimately. And that is where we can now arrive at the point where we can take up Sri Aurobindo's exposition of love. We will begin it today. In the Gita it is said that he loves him most who knows God. What is the relation between knowledge and love? If we take knowledge in the sense of a mental appreciation, of a mental analysis of what is God, what is not God, what leads to God, what leads away from God, that is not the kind of love that is related, that is not the kind of knowledge that is related to love. But the knowledge which lands you in the lap of God, that God is within me, that the God is around, that I have no existence apart from God, that I breathe because of God and I live because of him. When that knowledge is filled in myself, when streams of that knowledge flow through my veins, can I help not vibrating with love for the same divinity? No, love is the crown of knowledge. Knowledge ends in love. True knowledge ends in love. Even as real, wide, spontaneous knowledge, which is either vouchsafed or springs from the fount of the heart, leads one to the perception of the existence of God everywhere. Love opens so many windows, so many gates on the reality that is God. One cannot escape perceiving God when one is filled with love for God. Knowledge, even as knowledge culminates in love, full love leads to an integral knowledge. We will take up the subject in closer analysis in our next talk. Before I invite questions as usual, I would like to make a few observations on a question that has been raised time and again and which has been posed to me by more than one person. A question that I heard aired about in a meeting on the 21st where I was called to address the audience regarding planning. Planning or no planning? For a spiritual seeker, we are not discussing the 5-year plans and 10-year plans of the Government of India. We are discussing the question of planning or no planning in the perspective of a spiritual seeker. A seeker who believes in the manifestation of the Divine, who believes that the Kingdom of God can be established and made living on earth. Is he to accept planning as part of the scheme, or is he to leave everything to the moment-to-moment inspiration that comes from the Divine if we have only the receptivity to receive, to catch it? My experience, I will not speak at the moment of my understanding or my knowledge of the question, but my experience during the last 3 decades of life here under Mother and Sri Aurobindo is this. On the physical plane, on the material plane, a detailed, planned anticipation and organization is necessary. At a level which is above the physical, the level more appropriately, which is above the mental domain, where the mind ceases to work logically and according to reason. Beyond that, there can be no question of planning with the mind. But in the area which is covered by the mind and assigned to the mind by God, planning has a place and an important place. The first time I learned about the value attached by Mother to detailed planning and putting it down on paper was in 1951, when there was a convention called to initiate a center of education in memory of Sri Aurobindo, who had passed away in 1950 December on the 5th. It was something new in our ashram to we have a sort of a function with so many outside people who are not devotees to be called, treated as guests, and then holding a function, passing resolutions and that sort of thing. Somehow, I had to deal. All the correspondence letters used to come, and they were all being handed to me. I used to answer, I used to make the notes. So when so many hundreds of people were coming, we had only a limited accommodation. Somehow I ventured and noted down who is to stay where, arranged things. And then I had necessarily to think, these are all new people, who is to meet them, who is to bring them, and how are the 3 days to be occupied. So I had to draw up a detailed program. I worked out from my mind hour to hour program for all those delegates, and then had to think who will be responsible for which people in which guest houses, who are coming by which trains, buses and all that. I drew up a detailed plan, and when I typed it out, it ran into 2 or 3 pages. At that time, I was not going to the Mother as frequently as I used to do later on. And when my paper was taken by either Nolini or Amrita to the Mother, and they just said, he has given his paper regarding, they were not sure how Mother would receive. They said, these are all detailed things where she won't have time. They said, he has given this paper and showed her. Then she read the first line and she was very much interested, asked him to read. Then she heard very patiently, with great interest, the last line, and then said, after hearing everything, magnifique, it is magnificent. And she was so pleased that she sent me a special word about it, and the whole program was followed. And thereafter, she encouraged me positively every time on such and similar occasions to plan out the whole program and present it to her. Now this gave me an inkling that even for a spiritual person, even for a person who is guided moment to moment, planning in detail had a certain importance. That was reinforced when I read a letter by Sri Aurobindo, when he said, on the material plane, unless there is organization, unless there is planning, things are likely to end in confusion. So many possibilities are there. So many possibilities are likely to spring up. But the virtue of a plan is in its being flexible. We take certain suppositions and plan out. But if the planner is intelligent, awake to the possibilities that are abroad, he has to visualize, anticipate alternatives of the possibilities that may spring up, and provide enough scope for adaptation of the plan. So it is there that the element of what may be called no planning comes. So the level on which planning has to be is one, the level on which we are normally functioning, the level on which there has to be a certain flexibility within that framework is a little higher, and there is a level beyond the mind where the mind has to be absolutely silent without preparing any patterns, allowing the things that come to form themselves. And until one has that consciousness where one can live and feel and receive in the non-planning domain, one is obliged to function with the faculties that are active in him. one must pour himself, pour his energies from the level of the consciousness which he is living, maybe the highest level of the consciousness that he has attained. I also remember another small incident. For some time, I was associated with the reception of guests during the December 1st and 2nd festivals. We had number of chairs, and the old system was on each chair there used to be a label who used to sit where. So there were 300 to 400 chairs, labels should be put, all the local dignitaries should be received. One day it occurred to me as we were running about that why not make blocks of chairs, professionals, educationists, ministers, such type, so that anybody coming without having to know the name and taking him to a particular chair, we guide him to a particular block. And that was very readily and enthusiastically accepted by my colleagues. We gently removed all the labels. First year it succeeded very well. Second year, that success of my experiment of no planning, removing those things, emboldened me to still simplify the procedure. I said, even so many blocks are not necessary. Let us make only two wings. And then, as things would have it, either, I don't remember now, my memory is failing, either I fell ill or I was preoccupied with some other assignment that was given to me. I think, yes, there was some recitation I had to do, and I was rushed to the in the stage. And when people came, I had not anticipated that. Everything went into confusion, and the theatre had been newly built. 900 was the accommodation, 1400 people arrived, and nobody knew where to go. Mother stood like this, watching. People, huge crowd. But she kept quiet. But then, to set aside the noise, we started a little earlier our singing and other functions. People became quiet. But the next day she gently observed, I don't understand why that system of putting labels and arranging chairs that way was given up. He just observed that. Thereafter, we abolished all our quixotic non-planning and said no, we drew up the plan. Somebody went and measured with the yardstick how many seats could be managed. She was told 950, and thereafter it was decided that December 3rd the drama or the play should be divided between the ashram people on one day and the local guests on another, December 2nd and December 3rd. Because they could not all be physically accommodated on the same day. And she said, hereafter I want detailed report of how many seats are there, how many people can sit on the ground, how many on the chair, how many in the gallery, how many invitations. All these details she would go through, just to show us, not that she was that interested, to show us that we have to apply the mind and we have to be precise. So many times she has told me, be precise. Unless you are precise, I cannot help you. When reports are given to her of somebody's illness, some accident, some situation outside needing mother's help, she was particular that details to the last precise point were supplied to her. Otherwise, she said she could not. I will tell you another incident. Long before the ashram was formed, one of the old devotees of Sri Aurobindo, his wife was seriously ill. At that time, mother was not called mother. It was 1923, 1924, or 1925 perhaps. His wife was seriously ill. So he had come here, he told Sri Aurobindo that it is not responding to medical treatment. And then Sri Aurobindo conveyed that description to mother and told her to help. So mother used to always do these things at night. So she reported to mother, yes, I have done the needful. But when the report came, there was no improvement. So when this went on, every time she tried, and every time the report came that there was no substantial improvement. Then mother insisted on another report of the exact location of the trouble, where she is sleeping, what is the trouble, everything, a fresh report. And when the new report came, an error was discovered that the husband had said particular thing is happening in the right side, whereas it was happening on the left side. And when mother went in a subtle way, she worked on the data supplied to her. You can very well say, conscious, subtle consciousness, take cognizance of what is wrong where. Well, but it is not. She is given certain data, on that she works. She was told on the right side she went and did, I suppose she did put her pressure there. And thereafter when she was told, oh, I see, now I understand, this is what has been told to me. That was long ago, these you won't find in records, but this happened long before the ashram formed. So, with all deference to people who think otherwise, I say, based upon what mother and Sri Aurobindo have written, have told orally, that as long as I do not have that consciousness which sees in masses, which receives in a different way, understands things without having to organize them mentally, I have to have recourse to a flexible planning. Planning on our plane is a necessary part of divine manifestation on our plane. In the subtler worlds, planning may not be part of the program. Things manifest and they just automatically take the pattern that is intended. That is why they are called the typal worlds. Ours is a formative world, a world of immense possibilities. So whichever direction you give from this end, there the possibilities will flow. Otherwise, they will come in, various possibilities from other regions will come up, confusion will result. Now I would welcome any questions or queries.
Very important how does it join with what Mother says about not announcing beforehand what one is to do, not to beat the drum, in an endeavor which will be a collective effort? Such announcements are necessary, but in what way?
Until what is to happen or it is expected to happen, say a possibility for which we have been striving, until that has entered into the realm of certainty, it is unwise to speak of it, for the simple reason that it excites attention from its opposite tendencies, opposite formations, one. Second, there is always the possibility of a change above. Always the possibility of a change above for different reasons. But what she has said normally to us is, if you say, I am going to do this, immediately you provoke a reaction among the hostiles, I will see how you do it. That is why she said, don't even tell me herself that you are well. Tell it to me slowly, don't proclaim it. Because immediately something else springs up. That is why she says, don't announce, don't be in a hurry to proclaim. Till things are stabilized, till things are established, don't announce. As I told you, she had fixed the 24th of April for the announcement of the descent of the supramental power. It took place on February 29. Though it took place, she did not announce publicly. And it was only after she prepared the ground firmly that she took the 24th occasion to make it a public announcement.
So the way to proceed is not by announcement, but by a quiet preparatory.
We have a certain each person has a certain intuitive or inner feeling. This is likely to be, this is going to be. Now how best am I to render it into practice? How best? Shall I simply say, let it make its own movement, let it make it take its own direction? Or shall I prepare a direction through which I can work it out best? A collectivity, the best amongst us, shall we prepare how to work it out? If we prepare the grooves, we start working in that direction, a field is created for the descending force or the descending manifestation to work, if necessary to correct. But if nothing is there, if the field is simply vacant, this is not poetic inspiration. Even poetic inspiration, if it comes, if I am not ready with certain technique, with certain language, familiarity with the language, if I am not a poet of sorts, normally, how is this inspiration going to work? Even Sri Aurobindo, despite his deprecation of the excessive attention to technique, meter and all that, he did say a certain groundwork is necessary. It is for the inspiration to make use of it, to uplift it, to change it, but something has to be there. Something has to be there. Where you shall not allow the mental scheming or patterning faculty to function is at that level where we have to receive quietly without interfering, whether it is poetic inspiration or inspiration of an engineering type, whatever it is. There you have to be absolutely quiet, your mind shall not function. After you receive some image, some planning, you have to set to work how you are going to work out. Half a dozen plans, half a dozen patterns may emerge. That is inevitable. In the present condition of our mental ignorance, half a dozen plans are inevitable. If our mind had been developed, then there would be only one plan, corresponding to the idea, corresponding to the truth. Know it in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. When he speaks of the creation of the universe, creation coming out of the bosom of the Absolute, the Satchidananda, he speaks of the real idea. A real idea is what? Before the creation issues, in the idea behind it, the whole course, the whole career is previsaged. It is seen in a flash, in a seed form. Now, each individual ray emanating from the Divine has got this real idea behind it. And all the rest is a working out of that idea, the real idea. And what is real idea if not a master plan? Things are not left vacant there. What it is to work out, what aspect of the reality is to be manifested, and what will be the line on which the manifestation is to take place, that is determined. That is a planning. In the course of its working, there are dynamic variations. Each ray has its own plan. There is a divine plan behind all that appears to be planning or no planning. All that Mother says is, at all levels, don't bring in the mind. If when Mother was asked, how is the next creation going to take place if sex is not to be? She frankly admitted, I do not know. She could very well have formulated something and said. She said, we do not know, nature has not revealed that secret to us yet. Sri Aurobindo has also said the same thing in the supramental manifestation. So there we can say there can't be planning, there can't be anticipation. But when things are to be worked out, organized, on earth, given shape, planning is necessary. The domain of non-planning is the domain of a consciousness above the human. Till we breathe that air, in the Upanishads, there are great sentences, I am Brahma, I am the world, this is myself, that is myself. Now, how ridiculous it would be if I were to say it without having that experience. A professor says it in a college room, classroom, I am Brahma. Does it make any difference? Has it any impact? They say, unless you have that experience, unless you have that consciousness, that sentence is a theoretical maxim. This is a very convenient way of escaping one's responsibility. Mother has said no planning. Certainly mother has not said no planning under any conditions. I haven't seen mother telling Amrita. Amrita was her manager, most of you were not there perhaps when he was here. He was there for about 40 years. She said, for heaven's sake, don't rely upon your memory, don't rely upon your inspiration, take your paper and note down what I say. Note down everything that you have to do. She used to say, and he told me once, I always note because mother has told me. Don't rely upon other things. Note down. These are physical things you have to do. You may forget any possibilities. They are note down. All these, suppose you are asked, what is the blueprint for Auroville tomorrow? Are you going to maintain law and order? How are you going to maintain all these? Now these are things certainly we have not visualized yet. We do not know what are the conditions that will be. How far we will be given the autonomy to function without certain paraphernalia that go normally of a part of a state of Indian Union. We do not know yet. How are we going to say we are going to do without taxes, without money? We can't say. So there is the element of no planning. We have to see. We really do not know whether the government will grant us the status of a kind of Vatican, free port. There, we do not know. What will you do if such and such a thing happens? We do not know. There you can say, we have not thought of it. Honestly. But it is not for spiritual reasons. We have to plan to the best of our ability, to the highest light that we have been given, from the highest level of consciousness that we have attained. But keep ready to change the plans, keep open to alterations with the change in conditions. We are not called upon to plan out to the last and the least detail, but in a general way, for efficiency, for execution, on the physical plane, planning is a part of the integral plan. The planning has to be clothed in different forms. To technicians, it has to be communicated in one way. To to the general public in another way, to those who are specially interested in quite another way. According to the level of understanding of the group to which the communication is made, reports have to be framed.
Regarding the right use of technique, then what is the rendering savagery in the painting? Someone offensively with no grammar?
She herself gave the groundwork. She had her own sketches in pencil, and she asked the person in her presence to work upon them. And but she was given her own mother's own pencil sketches, isn't it? In certain matters, mother felt those who are steeped in technique, their very knowledge becomes a hindrance. She had always said that she was afraid of learned people. But she always insisted that people should have a certain discipline of mind, discipline of technique. But Savitri, she had a special case. She had certainly much better artists available to her who knew, who could render mother's ideas and images very effectively. But she felt that their grounding in certain established traditions of art, old and modern, would stand in the way of translation of the spirit of Savitri. She used her own pencil sketches, original sketches, to provide a sort of a scaffolding in which she asked the particular person to work. And personally, I have reasons to believe that mother chose that person because she knew the who is the being in that person, not because who the person is in this present life, but who the person must have been in the earlier life. There had been some connection. And mother tried that experiment. Whether the experiment would have led to different results if the instrument had been another, I wouldn't like to say now.
Connection between, it seems a very close connection between someone whom she prepared for visioning of Savitri, the same person being the guardian of Nathamandir. Would that indicate a connection?
No. No. Nobody will be the guardian or can be the guardian of Matar Mandir. Matar Mandir is going to be the guardian of all.
outside communications with them. Sri Aurobindo has said that the yoga should be revealed to mankind. Without that, it cannot take the next evolutionary step.
Mm. Mm.
In that revelation of the yoga to mankind,
it should not be revealed there. As far as the revelation of yoga is concerned, it has been already revealed fully. And there is nothing that need be withheld or doled out in bits as far as the yogic vision is concerned. Do I understand you correctly?
Well, it's the matter of in what different forms, other than the publication of Sri Aurobindo's books, can best bring the yoga to
practice, mind. Practice, yes. Books alone will not deliver the goods. Books can create a certain climate of interest, a certain willingness to look and understand, but the conviction, the proof has to come of the solid, of the validity, has to come only by practice. That is why the test of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Yoga means practice, isn't it?
That means especially when we come more and more into public view, that will become more and more exacting.
It is going to be exacting, and we can survive only as yogis, yogins. In the open world,